Hey, I'm Jeremy Loeb with BPR News. You're about to hear a conversation I had with Jeff Tabiri. He is WUNC's Capitol reporter. He has been covering Crossover Week. Well, let's talk about Crossover Week. And it sounds like somehow you survived. Congratulations.
Yeah, thanks. It's a time of heightened anxiety, and the speed of everything picks up around here. This is a decades-old legislative tradition in which bills need to make it from one chamber over to the other, or they die. Now, that's not entirely true, but that's what Crossover is largely about. And there were about 1,600 bills that were filed since January. So this is an opportunity to get rid of a lot of them and say, you know, death to this legislation, adios to that legislation. But there are bills that are not subject to Crossover, bills that have a fiscal note, that have an appropriation or a fee attached to them. Proposed constitutional amendments are not subject to Crossover. And there are other ways around this as well. So it works both ways. You know, there are proponents, there are opponents, and folks who enjoy it say that it's really a necessary deadline. One of the main criticisms I heard this week and have heard before about Crossover is that it moves, you know, the car from second to sixth gear, and things are moving very quickly, and it leads to, under Republicans, under Democrats, controversial legislation moving forward with some speed. And transparency and vetting are not always readily available in state governments. And again, that's under both parties, and that's probably not just in Raleigh. That's in a number of capital cities. But during Crossover, controversial legislation tends to move quickly, and opponents say that that's not always such a great thing.
Yeah, a lot of times things go through that haven't been really thoroughly vetted. You know, one of the examples of that, I guess, recently they had to do that class size bill, the fix to the mandated class sizes. Of course, that was the last budget, I think, that they put that in. But the criticisms of that was that it was kind of rushed through and they didn't really think through what the implications of that would be. So what happened with that bill?
Yeah, it's been a philosophy from state senators for a number of years to reduce class sizes in North Carolina, talking about maximum class size and average class size in K through 3. So, and also something that the Senate has done in recent years is they have put policy within the budget. And that's a bit of a change from what has been the norm. And there was a policy requirement in the budget that passed last summer that said class sizes had to reduce to a certain level beginning with the academic year that starts later this year. And what started to emerge from school districts all over the state was this concern about, their words, this is an unfunded mandate. So, you know, if you have 100 students and now you have to have 5 classes instead of 4 classes, you need an additional teacher. But there wasn't money in the school district's eyes for there to be also funding for PE teachers and art teachers and music teachers. So the concern became, if this reduction in class size goes into effect now, there isn't enough money to cover all these specialized teachers. And many school advocates and administrators from across the state were issuing a warning of there will be hundreds or thousands and thousands of layoffs if this is not dealt with. So a compromise was reached this week. It was signed quickly by the governor. We don't, of course, always see Democratic Governor Roy Cooper signing legislation quickly. And it effectively pushes this debate back for a year, also preserving, from best we can understand at this point, some of these jobs that perhaps were in question or that there was concern about, some of these specialist teachers.
Yeah, and now a name we'll probably discuss a lot, Republican Representative Chuck McGrady of Hendersonville. He introduced House Bill 13, which was the class size fix, but then after unanimous passage by the House, it sat in the Senate for a long time, so they finally introduced this compromise that they're terming it a compromise. And also Chuck McGrady had introduced this bill dealing with craft beer, which of course is very important to us out here in Western North Carolina. And there were some changes made to that bill. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, the two big provisions of House Bill 500 initially when it was rolled out were to increase the cap, the amount of barrels that a brewer can self-distribute over the course of a year. Presently, that cap is at 25,000 barrels, and the bill initially sought to increase that self-distribution limit to 200,000 barrels. The other key provision in that was that it would have made it a little bit easier, as I understand it, for craft brewers and distributors, or for a craft brewer to end his or her relationship with a wholesaler or a distributor. After considerable pushback and opposition from the Beer and Wine Wholesalers Association, those two provisions were taken out. So really the guts of the bill, the most significant policy changes were removed. So House Bill 500 did move forward, but for you know, some of the many breweries up in the Asheville region, the Asheville area, if they are self-distributing, they still cannot self-distribute beyond 25,000 barrels a year. They have to enter into an agreement with a wholesaler or a distributor. Opponents say that this is not in line with supporting small business and free enterprise, and it's kind of hypocritical, or that it is hypocritical, for the Republican Party, which prides itself, generally speaking, on supporting small business and limited government. You know, there are 200 brewers in North Carolina, craft breweries, and three of them are right at or close to this 25,000 barrel cap that are also self-distributing. Red Oak, which is in Guilford County, and then Noda and Old Mech down in the Charlotte area. I don't know of any in the Asheville area that self-distribute that are at that threshold. Obviously, Sierra Nevada makes hundreds of thousands of barrels in Mills River, and Oscar Blues produces a whole bunch as well. And Highland's another homegrown example. Those all use distributors. And you're allowed to do that at any point. You can start using a wholesaler or a distributor at day one. The indication now, what we're expecting, particularly from those two breweries down in Charlotte, they've been pretty outspoken, Old Mech and Noda. They're not happy with this. They say it is essentially squashing their business, and they're preparing a legal challenge. And it appears as though at this point, unless a legislative deal gets worked out, they're going to challenge the constitutionality on the whole of this self-distribution cap.
Oh, interesting. Okay. The Raise the Age effort, that was another McGrady bill, I believe. Was that a crossover bill or did that pass earlier? I can't remember.
The Raise the Age effort has not passed yet. It was not subject to crossover because it has a fiscal provision. So because there's money attached to the bill, and there's an appropriation, it didn't have to move this week.
I see.
This is the bill that across the board would no longer mandate that 16 and 17-year-olds are tried as adults. Earlier this year, the state of New York moved away from that. They were the only other state to still kind of have this in place. So North Carolina is the only state that uniformly charges 16 and 17-year-olds as adults. There has been a push for years to change this, but it hasn't moved through. And it, from the folks I talked to, there's more of an appetite, seems as though there is more of a groundswell this year. So we'll see if it actually moves, but it hasn't moved yet, and there will still be plenty of debate on this.
Now, the Attorney General, Josh Stein, has made a push to tackle the opioid crisis, and that's a bipartisan issue. Now, what's been going on with that legislation?
House Bill 243 is also known as the STOP Act. This is something that, yes, the Democratic Attorney General has been pushing in conjunction with a number of lawmakers. One of the primary sponsors on this, if I'm remembering correctly, is House Representative Greg Murphy, who's the only physician in the General Assembly, I believe. He represents an area out in Pitt County that includes parts of Greenville. And this stems from the opioid epidemic and the litany of problems, issues with prescription drug use and, you know, folks turning to heroin and the problems we've seen across the state and across this country. So this bill tries to get at that, and specifically it deals with prescription guidelines for opiates, for opioids. And it moved a few weeks ago.
I see.
Something that moved with overwhelming support. The bill itself is not something that's going to affect people who are in palliative or hospice care, have chronic pain, if I'm remembering that correctly. But it's an effort to reduce the number of pills that are going out because I believe it was last year there were 10 million prescriptions, not just pills, but prescriptions for opiates that were written in this state. I mean, that's one for every person. It's one of the talking points the Attorney General likes to note. But there are a lot of these pills, so they're trying to cut back on the number of pills that are getting out there.
Yeah. Now, one of the bills that we've been looking at closely is the Asheville Districts Bill. That bill passed through the Senate. That was sponsored by Republican Senator Chuck Edwards, and that would split Asheville into districts for the purpose of electing city council members. And that's controversial because it's opposed by the city council, the mayor, and, of course, all the Democrats that are representing Buncombe County. And, Jeff, you this is something that you've covered in other parts of the state over the years now.
Yeah, this speaks to a larger trend of state versus local power. I mean, to some extent, you could tether that to House Bill 2, but there's also the Asheville water issue from a few years ago, right? And there was authority over the airport in Charlotte. So some of this on a broad spectrum is state versus local power. In terms of redistricting, the General Assembly has changed Wake County commissioner districts. They've gone and altered the school board there. They have adjusted the Greensboro City Council seats. And There have been legal challenges to those three. If I'm remembering correctly, all three of those have been struck down, the bills that were passed by the General Assembly, and redistricting efforts that have been passed by the General Assembly in recent years pertaining to state legislative districts and congressional seats have also been struck down. So the General Assembly doesn't have a great track record when it comes to drawing maps. And this Asheville redistricting proposal, I would, you know, be willing to make a wager that it will, if it does in fact move through the House, it will see a legal challenge at some point.
The city council and the mayor are discussing whether or not to move forward with litigation if it does become law, because they are working on a referendum for voters as we speak, actually, before this bill is even passed. They're looking to put this on the November ballot to see whether voters want this or not. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, interesting stuff. Well, you know, I know a lot happened over the past week. Are there any things that stand out to you?
So after the Senate adjourned for the week following this crossover week yesterday, a week in which about 250 pieces of legislation were passed, a few of us in the Capitol press corps chatted with Senate Leader Phil Berger, and we asked him, you know, what was top of mind, what he was glad to see move and get through one chamber during this crossover week. And he mentioned elections bills. And I did take notice of what felt like a number of elections bills that moved this week, not only the Asheville redistricting issue, but also a ballot order, a measure that would make it easier for third-party candidates or unaffiliated candidates to get on the ballot. There was kind of a litany of things, one dealing with primary times, one dealing with how late polling locations can stay open or extend time if there's an issue. And it just seemed like there were a number of elections bills. And of course, what are elections about? Elections are about power and are about retaining power and about, you know, using the framework which is in front of you, or trying to use the framework which is in front of you to maintain power. And this is a century-old practice in politics, whether it's Democrats or Republicans. You want to remain in power, and elections are the way that you do that. So we saw a number of proposals pertaining to elections in 2018 move this week, and we'll see if they move through the other chambers in the weeks to come.
Do you think that's a coincidence that all those things happened here at crossover week, when, you know, things happen late at night, they happen in a kind of a rushed fashion? And then, of course, there was that special session in December when I think Republicans took quite a bit of heat for rushing through these changes to election boards and things like that. Is that sort of a pattern, that we're making all these changes to election laws in kind of a rushed fashion?
It's a good question. I'm going to defer to Pricey Harrison, who's a Democrat from Guilford County, who I spoke with earlier this week. I was texting with her, trying to just get comment from her. I was working on a story about crossover, about what this whole week is about. And she said, quote, "I think it's sort of chaos by design, and we always end up rushing through bills that are very problematic. And Democrats did it too. I'm not going to fault just Republicans." So I'll stop there at the end of that quote. And she came out of a committee meeting, and she was running around. She had been in committee meetings for like five straight hours. And one of the pieces of legislation they were taking up dealt with, it was an economic terrorism bill, which would punish protesters. And this is the kind of legislation that has been introduced in other states that Harrison, the Democratic representative, said targets protesters like Black Lives Matter protesters. The other thing she said to me about that was, quote, "Last night," we were chatting on Wednesday, she said, "last night I received something like 1,700 emails related to one of the bills on the calendar. It's quite overwhelming. It's difficult to be prepared. You get the drafts of the new bills. At least we're getting them the night before now, the chance to review for five different committee meetings and 20 to 30 different bills. It makes for a long night and long days," close quote.
And you brought up that economic terrorism bill, and I know that that was one of those rare bills that actually died. And it was two Republicans that voted against it, and one of them was, again, Chuck McGrady.
That's right. That bill died in committee, and Mickey Mishaw, who's the oldest member of the House, also a Democrat from Durham County, African-American, he was friends with Martin Luther King. He was a civil rights activist, and still is, but he was part of the civil rights era 50 years ago. And when this bill was being debated in committee, we should note, in a committee room that did not have audio streaming or access for the public at large to listen in or view, Mickey Mishaw said, quote, "This bill that you have here is a piece of abomination that should be confined to the streets of hell forever." Then later on, he said, "I have been guilty of everything that you have charged in this document." So strong language.
Strong words, yeah.
some of the drama, and that bill was killed this week in committee.
Jeff, thank you so much for talking to me. I appreciate it.
Jeremy, my pleasure.